Friends, today we'll be talking about two primary subjects, redistricting and the census. And I guess officially we're in order. And I'm going to take a moment. I'll introduce myself and then I'll have my members as well as my committee administrator to introduce themselves. I'm State Representative Raymond Dean. I have the pleasure of serving District 59B. In the state legislature, for those of you who don't know, the number 59B is the southern part of North Minneapolis and most of downtown Minneapolis. So again, welcome everybody. And we will actually start to my far left to my good friend and colleague, Jay Zhong.
Good morning, folks. My name is Jay Zhong. I represent District 67B. That is the southeast portion of St. Paul. I'm looking forward to having a very fruitful conversation with all of you about census today.
Good morning, everyone. State Representative Fu Lee from District 59A, just north of Chair Raymond Dean. And just want to say thank you all for being here, and also thank you to the City of Austin for hosting us here today.
Hi, State Representative Mike Freiberg, District 45B, all are parts of the cities of Crystal, Golden Valley, New Hope, and Robbinsdale. It's great to be in Austin. Thank you for welcoming us here with such open arms.
Hi, my name is Kristen Bonner. I'm the Vice Chair for the Elections Committee. I represent District 34B, which is Maple Grove and Osseo up in the northwest suburbs.
Oh. Hi, I'm Amanda Rudolph, and I'm the Committee Administrator for the Elections Committee.
Good morning, I'm Tony Juergens, State Representative for District 54B. I live in Cottage Grove. My district also includes Hastings and Afton, and it's good to be back in Austin. I was here about 2 years ago. I'm a member of the Capital Investment Committee, and we were here a couple years ago looking at some bonding projects, so it's good to be back.
Good morning. I'm Representative Michael Nelson. I represent 40A, which is the southern half of Brooklyn Park.
Hello, my name is Representative Tu Zhong, and I'm from the city of Maplewood. I represent 53A, which is Maplewood, Oakdale, Woodbury, and Landfoot's, the eastern suburbs. And I used to be a council member for the city of Maplewood, so this place feels very nice to be here. Council chair.
Well, great. Thank you, members, for joining us today. And again, thank you to the city of Austin for hosting us today. I'm going to call up our first individual to present, and that would be Matt Gearing from Nonpartisan House Research, and he will be talking about a few of these issues, starting with the census.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, I'm Matt Gearing from the Nonpartisan House Research Department. As you said, I staff elections and redistricting issues for the House. My presentation today is going to be fairly short, and mostly what I'd like to do is just orient you to the calendar and what you can expect in terms of redistricting process over the next sort of 12 to 24 to 36 months. As you all, I'm sure, are familiar with, redistricting is a high-profile topic and a high-profile issue that you, I'm certain, will hear about from other testifiers today. My job as sort of institutional staff of the House is to talk you through not the sort of political issues that you might deal with redistricting, but to talk you through the actual technical process and needs that you'll need to think about and policy choices you'll have to make in order to actually have the redistricting process be successful for the legislature in the next session. There should be a handout in your packet that's titled Redistricting 2020 Expected Timeline Scenarios. I'm going to walk through that calendar in just a bit, but first a couple of just sort of historical notes about Minnesota's redistricting process. Our state, there are lots of states that are sort of in the news right now related to their redistricting procedures and their maps. Minnesota is one of those states that hasn't been quite in the news in the last couple of decades, but that's not always the case. So Minnesota actually has a fairly robust history in terms of redistricting law and case law in previous decades. A couple of interesting notes: in the 1970s, the Minnesota legislative redistricting process actually went to the U.S. Supreme Court after a judge ordered the size of the legislature reduced by half, and that resulted in some case law that sort of established the way that courts look at legislative decision making in terms of how districts are drawn, what size the legislature might be. So there's U.S. Supreme Court precedent specifically out of Minnesota from the 70s on that point. And then also in the 1990s, there was case law, again, out of Minnesota that went all the way up to the Supreme Court related to the deference that federal courts give to state courts in deciding how maps should be drawn. So those are sort of technical issues that I'm not going to talk about in too much depth today, but just to sharing that just so you all understand that there is lots of case law and lots of sort of things that swirl around redistricting, and Minnesota has been involved in some of those issues in the past. So on your timeline map, what I'm going to mostly work through is the calendar that is under the heading of the default statutory procedure. So as you all know, there's a state constitutional requirement right now for the legislature to take responsibility for drawing new district maps after each decennial census. You'll hear about the census in a bit from the actual Census Bureau, so I'm not going to talk about that process too much. The process that exists in the Constitution delegates to you as the legislature responsibility both for state legislative districts as well as congressional districts. And so what you'll need to do in the next coming years will be to draw some maps. The maps will then go through the legislative process the same as any other piece of legislation. They get submitted to the governor for veto or approval, and then if the legislation is signed, then those maps become the official maps of the state, beginning with the 2022 election cycle. So to get from here where we are today to that point where we have new maps requires lots of steps and lots of different sort of technical things in addition to policy choices that you'll make, which we can talk about. I'm happy to take questions, or we can talk about in later committee hearings. But just in terms of the calendar things to expect, first, the official census date is April 1st of 2020. You'll hear about more about this in a bit. Redistricting for your purposes will really sort of hit the races at the end of 2020. So by December 31st of 2020, we'll have the initial set of data from the census that shows the statewide population total. And that number will be used to do the reapportionment process of redistricting. So there's a distinction between reapportionment and redistricting. Reapportionment is the process where we learn how many seats in Congress Minnesota will have. And so we're right on the bubble. I think Ms. Brower will talk a bit later about the population trends in the state and how that might affect our apportionment of members of Congress. So we'll have that data and information by December 31st of 2020. So then once we get that information, you will know sort of what your job is going forward and whether we will have 8 seats or 7 seats or some other number of seats based on the census. During the 2021 legislative session, this is when sort of the real work of redistricting will begin. It's kind of a decision for leadership on how the committee structure is organized, but in the past, in the House at least, what has happened is there will be a separate committee, kind of just like this, that is primarily a redistricting committee, and your responsibility is then to actually draw the map. So you have public hearings and sort of the normal things that go along with having a committee, and then the committee will produce a bill that has maps for both congressional districts and legislative districts. There's particular pieces of technology we use to draw those maps, and again, that's an issue we can talk about maybe at a later meeting, but we'll have the infrastructure set up for you to actually do the maps in a sort of computer room where you can draw districts and decide what you're comfortable with, and then we'll process that in the form of a bill, and then we'll go through the regular legislative process. The specific data that you'll use to draw maps won't be available to us until April 1st of 2021. This is the sort of last day that the census has to release to each individual state what's called block-level detailed data. So this is in order to do districts, what you need is not just a statewide population total, but you also need specific demographic data about particular regions of the state to ensure that you're meeting constitutional requirements as well as statutory requirements for districts. So we'll get that information by April 1st of 2021, and then once we have that, then that's when you can really start drawing some maps. In February 15th of 2022 is the real deadline that you have to work with. That's the deadline in statute for enacting new maps. The reason for that deadline is that in addition to legislative and congressional districting, there's also a process of local redistricting. So once you have your maps in place, all the cities and towns and counties in the state, school districts need to then follow up and redraw their own district boundaries. So there's a process for that to occur after you've completed your work. And that all needs to happen in time for the state primary election, which will happen in August of 2022. So the last sort of key dates on the calendar, August 9th of 2022 will be the state primary election, as I said. Then November 8th, 2022 will be the general election, and that's the first election cycle where the new maps will need to be in place and used, and will then be the maps for the state going forward until the next census cycle. On the back of this calendar, I'm not going to talk through this calendar in particular detail. This is a calendar that illustrates the way that redistricting has gone in the last couple of decades. This is not a statutory procedure. This is, as you all, I'm certain, recognize the legislature has struggled in the last few decades to actually enact maps. There's different reasons for that. The process then that has played out in the 2000 and 2010 cycle has been that the Minnesota Supreme Court has been involved because there haven't been legislatively approved maps. And so the court has its own procedure that is sort of set out based on its own discretion, where a special panel is appointed. It's a panel of judges who then, if the legislature doesn't act, will then work to order its own maps and principles. So that's the process that's been followed in 2000 and in the 2010 cycle. The calendars on the back of your handout describe some of the dates and key points in those procedures. Again, this is not you shouldn't view this as sort of an alternate process that you could view. The constitutional requirement is for all of you to actually enact maps through the legislative process. So this is sort of the fail-safe process. So there will be maps that. That conform to constitutional requirements, but it's not it's not an optional process. This is what happens when the legislature can complete its work. In terms of policy choices, just a couple of thoughts about that for you to think about over the next year or so. Obviously the most sort of high-profile issue that you've heard about, this committee has heard a couple of bills in the last session related to redistricting commissions. If you wish to enact a commission, that's a different procedure for drawing maps. The commission could be advisory or it could be mandatory. If you want to defer to a commission to actually order and direct new maps, that would be a constitutional amendment would be required to do that. There is still time in the calendar to make that happen. So as I said, the real work of redistricting starts in 2021 through 2022. So if you look at the calendar, it would be possible, if you wish to propose it this way, to have a constitutional amendment proposed to the voters at the 2020 election, have it be ratified, and have the commission get to work in 2021. So it's a tight timeline, but it's still doable if that's a route you wish to take. Another approach would be to enact an advisory commission. So this is more in line with the model of the legislation that you saw from Representative Cleborne and Representative Schultz last session, that creates a commission that would recommend to the legislature map boundaries. And again, there is time in the calendar. It's tight, but it is still possible for you to appoint a commission to do that work and to make recommendations to you during the 2021 and 2022 cycles. So considering whether you'd like to take that approach or not, that's sort of a policy choice for all of you to make. But I just want to let you know that it is still a live option if you wish to go that route. Another policy choice for you to think about is the principles that you want to use in drawing maps. So there's some constitutional, what we call sort of traditional redistricting principles. So these are principles of equal population having sort of compact districts and some other sort of technical standards that are required sort of no matter what. But then you also have the option to layer on additional principles if you'd like. So sort of commonly talked about principles that are in the news now would include things like how you use political data in drawing boundaries and some other principles like that. So the principles only exist to the extent that you enact them. So you could choose to make a list of principles and enact them and have them govern your work. That's something that you could do separately this next session, or you could wait until the actual redistricting work begins and then decide at that time how you'd like the principles to apply. A third sort of policy choice that I often get questions about in my office is the extent of public involvement in redistricting. There's lots of different models for how you do this. So in some states, members of the public are allowed to actually draw their own maps and submit them to a committee for review. In other states, there's sort of public hearing settings where members of the public can come and testify and provide their input. Whether you'd like to, or in what sense you'd like to have public involvement in this process is a policy choice for you to make as you think about how you're going to organize the structure for the next couple of years. Then finally, but sort of policy, it's not necessarily a policy choice, but sort of a thought for you to keep in mind, is, as I mentioned, the your responsibility really is for congressional and legislative districting, but what you're going to do is trigger redistricting at the local level. And so thinking about how you engage with your local city council members and mayors and school board members and county officials on that process will be important. I expect that you're going to have lots of questions from your local officials in your districts about what their responsibilities are. And so I'm happy to help you work through that as we get there, but just keep in mind that some engagement with local officials will be a part of this process, and they'll have particular needs that will rely on the work that you're doing to get their districts completed on time as well. And then finally, just a couple of resources just to make you aware of. There are lots of organizations and groups out there that are happy to sort of give you advice or consultation on how redistricting might work. Some of those are advocacy groups, others are more nonpartisan in nature. One organization that I think is particularly useful that I would recommend is the National Conference of State Legislatures. So they're an organization that works with the legislature sort of as at an institutional level, and they have a lot of good work that they do on redistricting issues, and I'm comfortable they do it in a sort of nonpartisan kind of advisory capacity. So to the extent that you have the ability to go to some NCSL conferences on redistricting or have access to their website for some of their materials, that would be a useful resource for you. Within Minnesota, I'll be the primary legislative staff, nonpartisan staff person working on redistricting for the House. We also have a couple of staff in the LCC that are sort of technical experts on the technical side and sort of map drawing side of redistricting, so they'll be available to you as well. And I think with that, Mr. Chair, I'm open to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Do any members have any questions? I would have one very brief question regarding the redistricting and what we're going to actually move forward with at some point in the future. There's no constitutional guidelines, state constitution, relative to which body has to originate with the first proposal for redistricting lines. Is there or is there not?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There's not the only responsibility in the state constitution is for the legislature to enact laws that adopt maps. So the legislation can begin either body. And keep in mind, you'll be doing both maps for House districts as well as Senate districts. And so both bodies will have to work together on that aspect of the process because it's a normal piece of legislation that goes through both bodies to be enacted.
Sure. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions. So just wanted to make sure I understood a couple things. So if we want to have a commission that approves legislative maps in a binding manner, it needs to be done by amendment to the state constitution. Is that correct?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, yes, that's correct. So the way that the state constitution is structured right now, it delegates to the legislature the responsibility to enact maps. And so if you there are lots of ways you can structure that process, but if you want to defer to an outside body that is not a legislative body to enact maps, that does require a constitutional amendment.
Representative Frank.
Thanks. And then just to follow up, so then if we wanted to have a commission that makes binding maps that we can't change ourselves as legislators, and which I think we should since we have kind of a self-interest in doing so. But if we wanted there to be a commission that had a mandate on what the district lines are, we would need to, and we wanted to do it in time for this upcoming redistricting cycle, it would need to pass in the 2020 session, right? Because it would, to be in the state constitution, it would need to go in front of the voters, and then the next time there's a state election after 2020 would be 2022, and by that point it's too late because that'll be the election with the new lines in place. So if we don't do it in 2020, if we don't do it in the 2020 session, we'll run out of time, essentially. Is that accurate?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, yeah, so that's correct. So the way that a constitutional amendment works is that you have to propose a constitutional amendment through the legislative process, so you need a majority vote in both the House and the Senate. Then it needs to be voted on at a state general election, and so the next general election will be 2020. the redistricting needs to be completed by February of 2022. And so the sort of last opportunity to have an amendment be ratified will be in 2020.
Just a follow-up to that, Mr. Gehring. So if we do put forward legislation that passes, it's similar to this year with the advisory committee, there's nothing that prohibits us from passing it both in the House and the Senate and having the governor sign it prior to the end of session. So their work could actually start much sooner than what might be considered if it was the instance of a constitutional amendment that created a created a new mandate for an independent group.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's correct. And I would encourage, if you're considering that approach, that the more time you can give a new commission to sort of get up to speed and understand the sort of both technical aspects and legal aspects, as well as kind of the broader mission that they have, the better off they're going to be. But also keep in mind that because of the 2022 deadline, you do still have, 18 or 24 months to let the commission get their work done. So, more time is better, but there is still plenty of time for an advisory group to be enacted this session and get to work.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Go ahead. No? I wish I was playing down there.
Oh, okay. Oh, Representative Fuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on Representative Fiber's point, I don't know if you can answer this or maybe somebody from the Secretary of State. Administratively, when do we need to, if we were going to do that, to get it passed and be able to have enough time to put it onto the 2020 ballots?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, so I would say you do have till the end of the legislative session to enact constitutional amendments, so there'll be the question itself will go on the November 2020 ballot, and the ballot won't be finalized until September of 2020, so I think you're safe through the end of the 2020 legislative session to propose that change if you'd like.
Representative Young.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gehring, I'm just curious, how many other states have such a commission that deals with the census?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jung, there's a good handful of states, and I don't want to give a number now because it seems to be changing, and depending on what type of structure the commission has, I don't want to sort of paint them all with the same brush. But I would say it's a strong minority of states that have a commission model at this point.
We're good. Now, Representative.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to point out 10 years ago, California had an initiative in their zero year election to create this binding commission, and they were able to do 10 years ago their commission or their redistricting with that commission, and it's a binding commission. It was a constitutional amendment, so there is time, but it might be tight.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Gehring. And now I'm going to call up Sam Fettig and Andrew Verdon and Emmett Morris. And I don't know how you guys want to tag team and hand off and do all this, but I'm going to leave that to you. Whoever starts, okay. Just please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Emmett Morris, and I'm partnership coordinator for the states of Minnesota and Missouri with the U.S. Census Bureau. And with me is my colleague and the team lead here in the state of Minnesota, Sam Fettig. He's also a media specialist. We also have another media specialist, Marie Schreiner, who's with us here today as well. So I'd like to start off just by thanking you for the opportunity for us to present with you today to attend this meeting. I'm going to just give you kind of a broad brushstroke of our setup here in Minnesota, and then I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Sam, who will talk about our operations component. And then I'm going to end it by going back and talking about our partnership component. So looking at the census in terms of how we do the operation, it involves a series of timelines and processes that Sam will go into more detail to talk to you about. And then, again, I'm going to end up talking about how we engage with various publics, with various public entities and community organizations. For example, one organization is with us here, the State Data Center, and also the Minnesota Census Mobilization Partnership, and the Minnesota Council on Foundations and others. We engage with these entities to make people more aware and to get them more involved and engaged with why the census is important. And so without further ado, I'm going to let Sam start us off, and then I'll come in a little bit later.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Fentek. And could you state your name for the record?
Absolutely.
Are we recording this, by the
way? We are. Okay, so yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sam Fettig, Minnesota Partnership Team Lead with the U.S. Census Bureau, based here in Minnesota. So as Emmett mentioned, just going to give you kind of an overview of our operations, what you can expect as far as timeline, and what will be happening on the ground as we approach the 2020 census. First, a brief message from our regional director. Minnesota is part of the Chicago region. Ms. Marilyn Sanders, our director, would welcome any of you to reach out anytime. I know Amanda has her contact information and would be, I'm sure, glad to share it. So the census, as I think we most of us know, is required in the Constitution. Every 10 years, a headcount of every person living in the United States. Title 13 of the U.S. Code states that no private data acquired by the Census Bureau will ever be shared with anyone, including other federal agencies. The two primary purposes of census data are apportionment, representation in Congress, as well as redistricting at the state and local level, and then for funding. Over $675 billion in federal funding every year is based on census data. So our first major operation, getting into the timeline a little bit, has actually just wrapped up in Minnesota. This is address canvassing. This is updating essentially our list of everywhere that people might live so that when we do the census next year and we're trying to count who lives where, we have an accurate list of where. So this began in August and has actually now concluded in Minnesota, updating our address list as we head into the count next year. Group quarters is a piece of our count strategy. It refers to any building where people get services but maybe don't have a traditional address. We work with the building managers of these group quarters buildings, a couple different examples on the slide, to figure out the best way to count the population in that facility. It could be a roster count where the management counts everyone in it. It could be that a stack of paper forms is brought around within the building. But that's a piece of our operation that starts up earlier than the main count as well, so I wanted to mention that. And then non-response follow-up is the biggest field on-the-ground operation that the census conducts. This is what people think of as census workers, census takers out knocking on doors. This work will begin next year after people have a period of about a month and a half to self-respond before the door knocking starts. But we are in full recruitment mode right now for these positions. We're going to need thousands of workers across Minnesota in every county, in just about every census tract, if not every. And that recruiting, again, is going on now so that we can get people lined up when we need to start knocking doors early next year. So 2020 census, a lot can change in 10 years, obviously. Here are a few factors that we know have. Changing use of technology. This will be the first year that you can respond to the census online. So that's a big piece of changing technology. And as long as I'm mentioning that, there are three ways to self-respond: online, by phone, or the traditional paper form. A few other factors: increasingly mobile population. People are moving around a bit more than they were 10 years ago. More diverse population, and just a lot more information. People are getting, you know, calls for surveys and mail and email, and it's just a little more noise in the air this time around. This gives really broadly a good overview of kind of the five steps from start to finish on the census. We talked about the first piece, which is updating our address list. Then motivating people to respond is really what kind of all of our work, Emmett and I and the rest of our Minnesota team, partnership team, falls under. This is meeting with local elected officials, nonprofits, as well as media, advertising, all designed to engage people about why the census is important, safe, and easy to complete. Then starting in mid-March, the count will actually open up. That's when the online form and the phone lines will open and when mail will start going out. Conduct the count, including non-response follow-up. That's the door knocking to anyone who doesn't get the response in themselves. And then release the data, as was mentioned earlier, first the state-level data at the end of 2020, and then the local-level data by April 1st of 2021. cybersecurity risk mitigation. I won't spend too much time here because it gets a bit technical, but with online response, people understandably might have questions about cybersecurity. The Bureau has never had a cybersecurity breach, and we have strong plans in place to protect that data going forward. This is our full operational schedule. We've talked through a lot of it already. One piece I do want to pull out of here, the red circle, our area census offices. Those are our on-the-ground, in-the-field offices, are all in various stages of open now. There are three in Minnesota, one in Rochester, one in the Twin Cities, and one in Duluth. One thing I want to mention with those is that they are, you don't have to have access to those offices to work on the census. Our census taker jobs are work from home. You'll be issued a census phone and you clock in and clock out there. These are more of kind of data processing centers where we bring responses in. But I did want to mention that those are now opening up as of this month. So this is our direct mail calendar. I mentioned mid-March is when self-response will begin. The first two mailings people will get will be an invitation to go online to respond, first and foremost. Although with that, you will also have the option to call or to request the paper form. Once we get into April, one more reminder along the same lines, and then by mid-April, if you haven't responded in one of those three ways, you'll get a paper form sent directly to you. And then one more reminder at the end of April, reminding you again, here's the three ways. After that point, if you haven't responded, is when the door knocking would begin. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Emmett to talk a bit about our partnership program.
So we all are on the page with the census is about counting people. And our partnership aspect of doing the census is about engaging people, educating them, and encouraging them to get involved, to take an ownership of the process of doing the census, to plant the seeds of people being aware of the census. And with this, with the census, we find that a lot of people don't know that they don't know of what the impact is of the data, that the data actually determines decisions, that the data actually determines how dollars are spent for a variety of programs, that the data actually establishes the baseline for all federal agencies and funding. So the first wave in terms of our contact with the public is to talk to those trusted voices, those trusted community leaders and people who have influence in various communities, to get them on board so that we at the Census Bureau really start to take a back seat or become the backdrop and have them to take the front seat in terms of driving the message. The message is important, but also as important as the message are the messengers. So there are an array of institutions, organizations, and groups from all different levels of society, the business, the nonprofit sector, and the public sector that we began to reach out to get them to partner with us so that they can start to develop their own action plans, activities, to integrate the census message into things that they already have going on, and also to be creative in thinking of things that might capture the public's attention, since this only happens every 10 years. And of course, we will have many young people this time around, which are making up the bulk of our population at this point, this will be the very first census that they're active in. So we know that there are hard-to-count groups throughout the country, in every city, in every county, in every state. And so these become those targeted groups that we try to establish relationships with and build bridges with at the onset. I'm not going to go through the entire list, but children under 5 is the second most undercounted population cohort, only superseded by American Indian Alaska Native population in the country. Renters, millennials, minorities, veterans. This list is not completely exhaustive, but it lists those groups that we know traditionally have been hard to reach, and we have the data to prove it in terms of their response levels down to the tract level and also at the municipal level and state level. So we encourage our partnership specialists. There are about 17 of them in the state of Minnesota. We have some that are concentrated in the Twin Cities area, but we have spread them across the state. The state, I went in and divided the state up by regional development commissions because we thought that that was a nice way to, or a strategic way to divide up the state by counties for per specialist. Some specialists share a particular region, but most of them have just one region that they're working in. And so their task is to go out and form complete count committees with the local governments, and then eventually we'll be moving into talking with organizations and other aspects of the various communities. The philanthropic partners across the country, and especially here in Minnesota, have been really leading the charge this particular census. This is my third rodeo with the census. The last census, we were in the midst of a economic recession. We had the benefit of having the stimulus package, reinvestment money that came to the Bureau. We were able to hire more people. We had more money that we could allocate to, at various limited levels, to communities that applied for small grants for activities that would do promote the census. We're not at that point at this point. And so the philanthropic communities throughout this state and also in other states have stepped up to the plate to fill in that gap to a large extent. Our biggest mechanism in terms of outreach is the Complete Count Committee that's made up of, again, those trusted voices from a variety of sectors within each community. It can be one person. One of the smallest communities in the state of Missouri, perhaps you have one here in Minnesota, has 10 people. So the mayor, the chair of that town, is going to serve as the committee themselves. Another village that we have is only 83 people. The mayor or chair is going to serve as the committee, a one-man operation or one-woman operation. However, the size does not matter. It could be 30, 50 people. We're not interested in the number. We're interested in the products and what they can do and how they can conduct the outreach and get people on board with the census and try to mitigate and unplug those mythologies that are out there, the fear that's out there, the distrust that's out there, and put it in a proper perspective in terms of the benefits for being on board with participating. There's a state complete count committee in Minnesota. We are engaged with them as well. I've already gone over this. Our target is to look at those low response areas, not only those hard to enumerate populations, but those low response areas in terms of how people have traditionally, going back to the 2000 census and also the 2010 census, and more immediately looking at the American Community Survey in terms of those households or those percentages of households and census tracts that are least likely to respond past being prologue. That's where we concentrate a lot of our effort in terms of mobilizing the individuals that live in those census tracts. Our goal, again, is to count everyone, count them once, and count them in the right place. So this just the previous slide just went over who should be on a complete count committee. We can only give suggestions. I often say you should think about first inviting people who are maybe normally not at the table or maybe reticent to be at the table, and then build it up from there. This slide just goes over the various phases of the census. I have to say that I feel that we're continuously in a gear-up phase. We're continuously in an engagement phase and an education and encouragement phase, although we have it listed out here on the screen in various months and times. But they sort of all start to weave into one another, whether we're encouraging, engaging, or gearing up. Then we will have a reminder phase that's closer to the actual census. Sam mentioned earlier postcards that will be sent out. And then at the tail end, a thank you phase, which will be a number of different partners and individuals and entities that we'll want to thank. We do offer training for complete count committees, and that's something that the State Data Center has also been doing. So we've been coming at it from two ways, to give people the best practices and resources and tools that they can get up and running mobilizing and galvanizing their complete count committee outreach. Another element of the people aspect of the census, besides accounting and building the partnerships, is hiring people. We are in the midst of hiring people for those local offices. We are in the midst of building up our applicant pool for down the road when we start non-response follow-up, where we have census workers go around door to door to those households who have not responded. And so recruitment, we want to recruit locally as much as possible because that's the best exercise in having someone that has an affinity or looks like the person on the other side of the door knocking on the door. So that's our goal. It's a goal that we don't often achieve, but at least that's what we aim for. So we need people to conduct the census, and the census has always been the largest civilian mobilization of the federal government since its beginning. This particular census is the 24th decennial census, the first being in 1790. Our recruiting process is a little bit streamlined than it has been. We're looking at biodata, we're looking at your life experience, and not whether you're good at math, good at geography, or the combination of geography and math. Fortunately, technology has allowed us to replace some of those other requirements that we used to look for in applicants, and allows us to expand our applicant pool. So anyone can apply. Anyone is eligible to apply. If you go to our website and put in your zip code, it will populate those positions that are available to you. We can get more detailed information to you on the application process and the telephone number. Most of the application process, of course, is online. This is one of the tools that I referred to earlier. This is the mailback participation rate from the 2010 census, and it gives a percentage of households that did respond, and the remainder of that out of 100 are those that we had to go around door to door to knock on the doors to get people to respond. And then we have a response outreach area map, which looks at the American Community Survey, which is done at 5, 3, and 1 year intervals. And we look at this information to see those households that have not responded to the American Community Survey. And so that helps us in terms of informing our action plans with the Census Bureau and also with our partners in terms of where we need to conduct our outreach. At this instance, I'm going to turn it back over to Sam to complete our presentation on talking about media resources.
Thanks, Emmett. Again, Sam Fedig, Minnesota Partnership Team Lead. So we have some good media resources available. In particular, the recruiting toolkit listed up here has some great resources for social media, email engagement to help recruit applicants from your networks that you have from your communities. And then as a piece of that and more broadly, one of our big asks in this phase and going forward is to engage your media channels, whether that's social media, legislative email update lists, or local earned media, if you have a relationship with your local paper or radio station, engaging those networks to get the message out about the importance of the census, the safety, the ease, as well as the job opportunities that we have. And I don't know if we'd like to do questions now or after Andrew's segment.
Let's have Mr. Rubin present. And
then excellent. Thank you.
Do a few questions. And I want to make sure that we try to keep on time schedule too, because I know we have some public testifiers and I want to make sure that they have some time as well. So Mr. Verdon, if you could come forward, state your name and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you very much for having me. For the record, my name is Andrew Verdon. I'm the State Director of Census Operations and Engagement for the State of Minnesota. There are 182 days or 26 Taco Tuesdays until the census. So this is very important that we all participate. I want to be respectful of your time here. So I'll go through some highline numbers for you. According to the Census Bureau, there's 17.7% of Minnesota's population will not fill out their census forms. That's 965,000 Minnesotans who will not fill out their form without assistance. 95,942 of those people live in Minneapolis, 69,808 in St. Paul. But I don't want to forget the rest of you either. Representative Juergens, 3,866 people in Hastings are likely not to fill out their forms. 6,976 in Maplewood, 3,310 in New Hope, 8,576 in Maple Grove. And here in Austin, 5,597 people. We're talking about real money. We're talking about real people, and this is very, very important stuff. This is instrumental to everything that we that you are here to do. I used to work on the elections subcommittee, so it's very fond to my heart to be here. I want to recognize those of you who helped pass and get some money for the state of Minnesota. We were given $1.6 million by the legislature, by the governor last year. That amounts to 26 cents per Minnesotan. Now, if that doesn't sound like a lot, well, our friends in Wisconsin have 0 cents. So, well, I guess you could say that about people in Wisconsin as a whole. But the fact of the matter is it's very important. The good news is that Minnesotans as a whole do participate in, at the census in very, very high rates, just like we volunteer, just like we vote, just like we donate our time and our money to things that, that matter to us. Minnesota ranked second in census participation rates in 2010. Again, second only to our dread rivals to the east, Wisconsin. So that's not going to happen this time. We will beat Wisconsin. But like Minnesota and the does on so many other areas where you look at our income or education or home ownership or income rates, as a whole we do very well, but there are certain populations that don't do so well. Emmett and Sam both referred to many of those already. Renters being number one. Communities of color, low-wealth communities, and all of your communities will have lots of people who will not be filling out their forms, either because of distrust of the government, fear of the government, hatred of the government, perhaps, or simply because they've got other things going on. So we appreciate all of your work. With the money that you've given us from the state of Minnesota, we've put out our first round of grants, $300,000 of grants, 400 grants of $750 each, for complete count committees that are established. This is an opportunity for cities and counties, like Austin, who is here in the room, has formed a complete count committee, are eligible for this funding, and that money can be used for digital organizing, can be used to organize in apartment buildings, and can be used to engage with historically undercount communities. Additional funds will be available in the spring once the actual census has begun, and it's specifically targeted to the complete count committees serving the historically undercounted communities who need it the most. With that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Verdon, and I'm going to steal the first question. So when we talk about the count and what each person counts, what's sort of the dollar amount that's associated with each person that tends to be counted in the census?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, so Minnesota receives approximately $15.5 billion a year from the federal government on the basis of the decennial census count. On a per capita basis, that's $2,796 per person per year, or almost $28,000 per person per decade. So this is we're talking about real money here. That does not include monies that is also appropriated by St. Paul on the basis of the census count, or that might be appropriated by the county or the city that's also on the basis of that count.
Thank you, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing up the $1.6 million. And I do want to say thank you to Chair Nelson over there for putting that into the state gov finance bill. So thank you for that. Can you tell me a little bit? You said that you have already spent $300,000. What is the timeline for the rest of the money? And can you remind us again what are the grants amount that people are applying for that you are giving out?
Sure. So, Mr. Chair, Representatives, so the $300,000 in grants are now open. They have not; it has not all been spent yet. The state of Minnesota, we've got approximately 171 complete count committees that have formed already, and we expect that they will be applying for that money. This is not a competitive grant process, but it is, however, first come, first serve for the first 400 in the door. Then subsequent monies will be made available in the spring, somewhere between $150,000 and $200,000, depending on how subscribed the first pot of money is taken, and that money will be granted to the complete count committees serving the historically undercounted communities who need the money the most. So.
Representative,
one follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And can you tell us where geographically these complete counts committee are? Like, do you have an exact number of how many are in the metro, how many are in northwest, northeast, south, southwest, southeast, so that we have an idea?
Mr.
Chair, Representatives, I'm afraid I can't provide that information to you off the top of my head, although I know how many Taco Tuesdays there are. The complete map is available on our website, MN 2020 Census. There's a map that shows where all of them are located. I can tell you that, broadly speaking, they are heavily concentrated in metro, although southern Minnesota is doing very well. Western Minnesota and northern Minnesota, not as much, at least not at this point in time.
Thank you. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Mr. Verdon, you mentioned that we've invested $1.6 million. It's about 26 cents per Minnesota resident, which is certainly good. I'm glad we have. It's a really important issue, and there was nothing in our state in our neighbor to the east. My understanding, though, is some states have done quite a bit more than this. Somebody told me California was, I forget the number, somewhere around 50 million, or maybe it was even closer to 100, but I don't remember the exact number. Is that accurate? I guess I'm just wondering, it's great we're doing so much more than our state neighbor to the east that's doing nothing, but, nothing is not a great standard of comparison. From what I've heard, it's still not that much compared to other states. Do you have a sense for how some of the states that have a more robust investment are doing?
Mr.
Chair, representatives, thank you for your comment, Representative Freiberg. The state of California is spending close to $190 million on the census. So that's over $4 per person is what they're spending on the census. Illinois has appropriated $40 million. New York State has appropriated $20 million. Washington State, $15.5 million, Oregon, $7.5 million, and Colorado, $5.5 million. But most states have nothing, right? And even with the $40 million from our friends from Illinois, that money, as we understand, is not going to be in the hands of the people who need the money until February of next year, which makes it very, very short time in which to do that. So while we may not have as much money as some of these other states, the thing that we have that the other states do not is a terrific partnership with our nonprofit partners, Minnesota Census Mobilization Project, Minnesota Council Foundations, Minnesota Council Nonprofits, who have been working on the census for 4 years already. And so there's one thing that you can't substitute on any campaign. You can always raise more money, you can always find more volunteers, but you cannot make more time. And so these states, while they have more money, many of them did not get that money until this summer, but they have not been working and thinking about this project as long as we have, and that's why we will regain our status as the number one participation rate in census in 2020.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Verdon. And I'll give you the last question, Vice Chair Boehner.
Thank you. It's good to be here in Austin. I actually have family here in Austin that I rarely get to see. And on that note, certainly we understand there are certain populations that are harder to count. Some of them listed on that graph that we saw earlier, farm workers, things like that. And I'm curious, we did a lot of conversation, and thank you, by the way, for that number, the 8,076 in Maple Grove that may not vote. But I'm just curious, because we are here outside of the metro area, do we know by chance the figures of folks who may not respond in greater Minnesota and what that could cost us in terms of real dollars?
Mr. Verdon.
Mr. Chair, Representative. The census has what's called the response outreach area mapper, which shows on a census tract level what the estimated participation rate for each area is. If you were to mouse over that map, it'll tell you what are the specific demographics of that tract, which make them likely to be missed. For example, how many renters are there? How many people of color are there? How many people who don't speak English well? How many people who do not have a high school diploma or a GED? Things along those lines. We've replicated that map and put that on our site as well, and so you can get an idea where the challenges are. It's kind of the map is kind of a heat map, so you can see where the issues are. But many of these categories, whether you're talking about ethnic and racial minorities, if you're talking about people with mental or physical disabilities, if you're talking about snowbirds, you're talking about 18 to 24 year olds, you're talking about children under five. Those are categories which are obviously all over the state.
Well, and I guess thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where I was headed with that really is that I know that a lot of our more smaller communities, particularly local and county level areas, have a lot less to work with financially. And so I guess I was trying to get at the importance of the sentence census and how that really plays a role, particularly in some of our more rural counties and municipalities, where making sure that every dollar really does count. Thank you for that.
And I'm going to retract that you got the last question. I'm actually going to give that to Representative Jurgens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure who's best to answer this, Mr. Verdon. I think it's perhaps you. But
and could we make it a brief answer as well as a brief question?
Yes. On my part, I can do that. I guess my question is, at what point are there diminishing returns? Obviously, it takes more time and effort and money to go door to door to get the answers, to get the census data. If people aren't home, how many times do you go back? Can a neighbor say, oh, yeah, they have three people living there? Does that count? I mean, just give me some a sense on when you just give up. And if you do, are there estimates then? Or do you have to actually be counted?
Mr. Bird.
Mr. Chair, representatives, yes, there is a limited number of times that someone from the Bureau itself can go to a given door. The Census Bureau believes that because of the new online option that it will be easier for people to fill out the form. I think that might be true, but not necessarily so, that will increase the overall participation rates. excuse me. I'm sorry. Repeat the second part of your question, please.
I think the second part was, are there any estimates? If you know that there are a certain number of people that aren't counted, and I think the other part of it was also, I forget the other part.
You asked if a neighbor could count, and I see you're having a friend come up to assist you, Mr. Verdon.
So it has to be an actual enumeration, so it has to be actual counted, so estimates are not involved. A neighbor or a postman or the owner or manager of the property can vouch for the number of people that were at a particular address.
Mr. Fettig, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I was just going to add briefly. We'll attempt in-person enumeration at the door up to six times before going to a proxy. And like Mr. Verdon mentioned, it'll never be an estimate. It has to be a count of every person, but it can be done by proxy.
Okay, with that, I'm going to thank all of you. I think if nothing else, many of us got a civics lesson today on the census. And now I'm going to ask Ms. Susan Brower, the state demographer, to come by through a presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hello, members. I will be brief. I just have been asked today to cover the demographic changes that have happened in the state and how they will impact apportionment and redistricting, and so I will quickly give you an overview of that, and then we can move on to public testimony. Well, I'm here all day if you want to ask me questions, but so let me just give you a sense of how we have been growing as a state and how that impacts both the apportionment that will happen after the next census and how it will impact state-level redistricting based on how the population has changed within the state since 2010. So since 2010, we've added about 307,000 additional Minnesotans. We're growing at about 35 to 40,000 additional people each year, and so we expect that that number will grow by 2020. As a state, we grow very well compared to Midwestern states, just not as fast as some of the states in the South and in the West of the U.S. We have been picking up pace in our growth over this decade. You can kind of see a slight incline here in the number of people that are added each year. And so you can see that the growth that we started out with at the beginning of the decade is a little bit less than it is now, and that will impact our apportionment as well. So the apportionment will happen. The numbers will be released in December of 2020. I believe, as Mr. Gehrig mentioned earlier, December 2020 is those high-level numbers. The numbers for each state will be put into a formula, and then the number of U.S. congressional seats will be doled out on the basis of that formula. Every state first gets one seat, and then on top of that, states are given a priority score based on their population number. And then the seats are doled out based on those priority scores. Now, if we look right now, these are two scenarios of growth that we can estimate, kind of the growth that has happened this decade and what it might mean for apportionment after 2020. The scenario on the left is showing you what it would look like if all states, including Minnesota, grew at a constant rate, the same rate that they've been growing since 2010, how the apportionment would shake out. And in that scenario, Minnesota would lose a congressional seat by about 27,000 people. Another scenario that we see on the right is if Minnesota and all other states were to continue to grow as they have grown in the last 2 years of growth, what would that mean if we carried that forward to 2020? And under that scenario, Minnesota keeps a seat by 26,000 additional folks. Any kind of congressional estimate of apportionment for 2020 is going to have an assumption of growth built into it. So if you hear someone who is very, very sure about whether we're going to lose a seat or keep a seat, I am skeptical because we not only have to project Minnesota's growth, we have to project the growth of 49 other states. And all of that will impact just how things shake out after the 2020 census. In addition to just the growth that is happening, the level of response to the census also plays in. If a state has a very good response rate, as we intend to do, that will help congressional apportionment because it's based on the number of people we count, not necessarily the number of people we have, but we hope those numbers are very close. So the estimates that we have right now, I don't know if it's helpful or not, but it tells us that we will either keep a seat or we will lose a seat. My interpretation of that is it could come down to just one additional person counted. It could go, you know, as far as 27,000 in one direction. According to most recent estimates, it could go 27,000 in the other direction, but it also could be much, much closer than that. What that means if we lose a congressional seat is that we split the state up into 7 equal pieces rather than 8 equal pieces. That grows our districts by about 100,000 people, diluting our representation at the federal level. And I think that is particularly felt in greater Minnesota when we look at the size of the districts that we have in many of these areas. Adding 100,000 additional folks to a region, to some of our districts like the district we're in today, will need to cover a considerable geographic area to accommodate those additional 100,000. I want to turn briefly now just to what redistricting might look like at the state level based on the growth that we have seen since 2010. Most of the growth has been concentrated in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, although almost all of our metro areas across the state have been growing. Most of that growth has been concentrated in the Twin Cities. And you can see here that about 83% of the state's growth in the 7 years showing here has happened in the 7-county Twin Cities metropolitan area. If we look at the fastest growing cities, since 2010, since the last census, Minneapolis and St. Paul top the list. That is not the norm based on past decades of growth. This is kind of a new growth pattern where we see more growth not only in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, but also right in the middle of the center cities. You can see here that about 45,000 additional folks have been added to the city of Minneapolis since 2010. That's a tremendous number for Minneapolis. Last decade between the 2000 and 2010 census, Minneapolis lost about 40 people. And so you can see that there's been a pretty big turnaround, and redistricting in 2022 will need to accommodate some of this growth. I also want to point out that while Minneapolis and St. Paul top this list, we do have strong growth in many of our metropolitan areas. You can see Rochester is on the list, Mankato is on the list. Many of our metropolitan suburban areas are on these lists. And the same is true, you know, at the state legislative level, that when we have growth in a particular area, those districts need to shrink to accommodate, the geographic size needs to shrink to accommodate that growth. And conversely, where we have less growth or population losses, those areas need to expand to make up that same number of people. We've done some estimates, and I'll finish here, just of the districts that have either grown the most or need to make up the most based on where we are at today in 2018. If we split the state up into the 134 state legislative districts, the 2018 population, we get an ideal district population of about 42,000, and you can see kind of the districts that are needing to make up the most or conversely have kind of overgone that allotment. So this is just intended to give you a sense of where the growth has happened or where we would expect to see adjustments where the growth either is not happening or is not keeping pace with other areas. I'm showing you here the largest city in each of those districts, but of course, as you well know, there are many other cities in many of these districts as well. So I will end it there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, how much is the legislative districts of the current number? I think it's 36,000 or
39,000.
How you're saying it's going to be 42,000, so about a 3,000 jump in the legislative districts to balance out? Is that kind of what I'm seeing there?
Ms. Brown.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, this is the 2018 number, the 42,000 number, so we've got a couple years of growth on top of that. I'd have to do the math for our 2020 projections, but it's going to be somewhere in that range.
From 3,000.
Yep.
Thank you. Any other questions? Great presentation. I always appreciate it when you come before the committee and let everybody know what's happening with the demographics in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members.
We're going to move on now to public testimony, and I have Eric Olson down first. And we're going to have roughly 2.5 to 3 minutes. So as much as you can do to compress your testimony, it'll help us to get out of here at noon. Please proceed. State your name for the record and proceed.
Sorry, I'm trying to get out of this. Yep. Good morning, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Eric Olson. I'm President and CEO of KSMQ Public Television, PBS serving southeastern Minnesota. Also here with Mohammed Sheikh Noor. And really, we're kind of the poster. We're one of the CCC first volunteer groups here, our Mohr County team, with just a little show and tell for you about what we've been working on. Mohammed, I should say, is from the Interpreting and Translation Programming Management of Intercultural Mutual Assistance Association in Rochester. As you mentioned, as it came up, with over 50 first languages spoken by residents here in southeastern Minnesota, combined with recent confusion in government about the census, immigration issues, KSMQ Public Television, our board, and one of our board members, Jeff Baldus, is here also this morning, came to the conclusion that we could perhaps help in a very small way and perform a unique public service to help educate our local communities about Census 2020.
Yes. Yeah, we are in the process of putting together a project we call Everyone Counts. Our goal is to create videos in 10 different languages. In that video, in a way welcoming, I will explain to residents who are new to Minnesota just what the census is. For many people who were not born in our country, a census is an unknown concept. These videos will explain why completing the census is so important and that one can participate in census without concern about sharing their household residence information.
So reaching out to immigrant communities specifically, we looked for an authority figure in the state to front these videos. We asked Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison and his office to introduce the videos. He readily agreed. We just filmed him like 2 weeks ago. So we're very early in the production project, so this is just a real fast, rough cut, not done by any stretch of the imagination, but wanted to give you a sense of what it's like.
Hi, I'm Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, and the 2020 census is nearly upon us. The census is a federal count of how many people are living in the United States. It's very important that every man, woman, and child is counted in the census. Census numbers determine funding levels for many, many government programs and services that each of us uses every day. Now, folks who live in rural communities of Minnesota, communities of color, immigrants, young children, and low-income groups have a history of being undercounted in our census. Maybe you have friends or neighbors who are new to Minnesota or even new to the United States. Would you please reach out to them and let them know how important the census is? And tell them that participating in the census is simple and safe. You can learn more about all of this at www.2020census.gov. Thank you for your time.
And then we'll have...
Hello, I'm Keith Ellison, Attorney General of the State of Minnesota.
مرحبا, أنا كيث أليسون, النائب العام لولاية مينيسوتا. أود أن أتكلم مباشرة إلى أولياء وأوصياء طلاب المدارس الإعدادية في وينونا.
The subject is the 2020 census.
الموضوع هو الإحصاء السكاني لعام 2020. يتم هذا الإحصاء في أمريكا كل 10 أعوام.
It's a national count.
والتعداد السكاني هو الإحصاء الوطني الذي تقوم به الحكومة.
So that's just a draft, obviously. But beginning in January, the completed video announcements, the English versions, will be broadcast on television via the stations of Minnesota Public Television Association, statewide, of which KSMQ is a member. But perhaps with these videos, and this is where the CCC really came in, more importantly, we're reaching out to public schools in our area.
Yeah. From an idea by Austin School Superintendent David Krantz, we will offer these announcements as language-specific video files to be placed on the student laptop computers. The students can take the laptop home and play the videos to parents or guardians and begin a dialogue about Census 2020.
So we have 10 different languages, and as David Superintendent Krenzi is at another hearing, or he'd be here with our CCC group, but at Austin High, every student has a laptop. And so they've vetted and checked that we can put one of the 10 languages on the laptop, and the student can bring it home, play it, translate. And finally, Mr. Chair, we've met with the Commissioner's Office, Department of Education, to investigate the possibility of statewide distribution to schools. In any case, as we mentioned, Austin Public Schools will be doing that. We'll be meeting with Rochester Schools, where Mohammed's from, and down in southeastern Minnesota. The Census Bureau has 50 different languages on their phone version of the census, so we're going to be pushing that option, too, to make it even better for all the of our communities. So, thank you. We'd be happy to answer questions.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Olson and Mr. Neward. Any questions from members? Thank you. Oh, I've got one here. Representative Bain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, Mr. Noor and Mr.
Olson.
Okay. First of all, thank you for the initiative to go forward and do this. I think it's a tremendous help, and I think getting the word out there involves a lot of out-of-the-box solutions. So I really applaud you for taking that step. And I'm just curious for the folks here, you mentioned that there are 10 other languages in which you're looking to translate this into. Is there any way you could give us just a brief account of what those languages are for folks who may be listening so they might be able to get in touch? And second part of that is how might they get in touch with you if they'd like to share that within their communities?
Sure.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So those languages will be the the language, those are widely spoken in Austin area. So there will be Karen, Karenni, Anuak, Dinka, Hmong, Kamai, Somali, and Spanish too.
And then we've also talked to the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota to bring some of the European languages also for the metro area, that even French, for the statewide piece. But Mohammed's agency is handling all the translations. Wonderful facility in Rochester.
Great. Any follow-up?
Just one. If folks are interested, how would they get in touch with you?
Sure. We're working that out right now through the affinity groups also, the Welcome Center in Austin, but also they can contact me at KSMQ until we get it worked out with, hopefully, with the Department of Education. We're hoping for a distribution there.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Olson, Mr. Noor. I'll now call Ann Castle to testify. And on deck, we have Jason. Please state your name for the record.
Hi, I'm Ann Castle.
I'm Scott Felton, one of the co-chairs of the Moore County Complete Count Committee.
So they talked about the complete count committees that are being formed around the state, and we are one of those committees. Scott is the auditor treasurer of Moore County, and I'm the city clerk of Austin. And then anybody from our CCC, can you stand up? These are representatives. They talked about forming relationships with key community groups, and that's exactly what we are doing here.
We have over 24 organizations and partners on our Complete Count Committee, including school districts in the county, nonprofit agencies, media outlets as well. So we feel we have a good involvement by our community and county.
They talked about the partnership that we're going with the school in order to send the laptops home with the kids. We also are trying to partner with our local libraries and different government buildings around town to create hotspots for people so they can come and fill it out on the internet. We're applying for one of those grants. We're trying to set up a transportation system for people who can't get to the library or a local place throughout Moore County. That's one of our ideas that we're going to apply for one of the $750 grants. So we are applying for that. We're utilizing it. We're trying to think out of the box to reach our hard to count people.
Our committee's been very active so far this summer and fall already with having a presence at many community events to get the word out about the census. We had a booth at our county fair. We've been at numerous, at multiple schools during the registration and open houses this late summer. And we've got additional events coming up that we'll be focusing on, as well as likely speaking with service clubs and things like that this winter to, again, promote the census, make sure people are aware of it, and reinforce how important it is for everybody to participate and to be counted.
So yeah, we've really been growing. We established our complete count committee in April. So we've been meeting with different groups every month, and we've been to many different events throughout the community. We've been giving out information. We got some water bottles. We have some other events. So they talked about that's interacting with the community, and we've really been trying to do that to provide as much information in as many languages as possible.
Great. Well, thank you, guys, and it sounds like you've been at this for quite some time, and we'll be probably a year in by the time the actual census starts, so thank you for that. Do members have any questions or comments? Okay, with that, thank you for your testimony, and we'll now move to, is it Jason Baskin?
Mr. Chairman, representatives, Jason Baskin, Austin City Council member, Ward 2, and former chair of our Human Rights Commission. And you've heard a lot today, both from the Census Bureau as well as our local community, about how we're thinking differently about the census. And I want to testify today a little bit about the why behind that. So Austin is really a microcosm of what's happening in our total state in terms of changing population and increasing diversity. In 1990, Austin was 2% non-white. And so when I grew up, the community looked very different than what it looks like today for our kids. The last census data in 2010 was 23% non-white, which is just a little bit behind where the Twin Cities are. And I would fully expect that number to be north of 30% after the 2020 census. And really a lot of this demographic diversity is being concentrated at the youth levels. And so at Austin Public Schools, the graduating class is over 50% non-white. Our oldest daughter's in first grade, and you're close to 55, 60% non-white. And we see 47 plus different languages spoken by families at home. And so as part of that changing demographic, from a community standpoint, we've tried to figure out what do we need to do to change and evolve the way that we communicate locally with our residents to serve them. And so we spent about 3 years between 2016 and 2018 putting together a strategic welcoming plan. And what we did is we went out into the community and identified by interviews and focus groups and one-on-one conversations, what are the biggest barriers to creating a truly welcoming community, and what are the biggest barriers to serving this evolving population? And we found a number of interesting things, but I think there's two that are specifically germane for today's topic. Number one is communication was by far the biggest barrier. And what we found is that communication goes well beyond languages. Communication goes into how do we reach communities. I think traditionally, you know, for me growing up in Austin, and I had a pretty good idea of who I needed to contact, where City Hall was, you know, how do you send an email. What we found is that we have a lot of groups that if we just hold the same meeting at the same place and expect different people to show up, we're not going to get a different result. And so communication is about building those authentic relationships and really going out to where our members of the community are, whether it's churches or potlucks or businesses, and building those relationships. The second thing that we found that I think is germane for this process is the fact that knowledge about how do we access government, either on the local level or really on a statewide level, is really, really minimal, especially for some of our newer populations. You know, I think even people that I grow up with, if you go down the neighborhood, you'd get a lot of questions when you go out and door knock and they ask, like who's our city council person now? And, you know, what does our city council do? And you exponentially increase that as you get into some of our evolving populations who maybe don't have as much of a demographic background. And so as we've thought about how do we better communicate, how do we better drive access to local institutions, I think you see a lot of the work that the groups in this room are doing, and I think it's something that can really be replicated statewide, which is we need to build those relationships, and we need to proactively go out to communities to make sure that they get counted, because if we just do the same things that we've done historically, we're going to get undercounted and ultimately won't benefit as a state. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Baskin. Any members have any questions at this time? Thank you for your presentation. Really appreciate it. And thanks for your service to the people of Austin.
Thank you very much.
Next up, I have Brian Boysen. Or someone other than Brian speaking on his behalf. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Amanda Kiefer. I'm speaking on behalf of Brian Boysen for the school district of Lisle, Minnesota. He is under the weather. I did get to call him this morning, and I was quickly typing, so bear with me. So Brian is involved in a lot of many school district events and within the community himself, and he also is on the Complete Count Committee from our county in the city of Austin. So speaking with him this morning, he's stating that we, him as a school district is depending on the complete census because the school districts tap into this government funding. It's very important, and that they're coming up short, and so then they're going into operating referendums in which the Lisle School District has a special election for a referendum coming up this November. He's looking to aid to reference the aid of the local districts to keep up and playing a good role in that education, because in small town USA that's very important. And Lisle is unique as they have a large open enrollment, and as most rural are declining in open enrollment, and which leads to decrease in aid. Maurer County as a whole is growing, and so is the Austin School District. They grew by 160 students last year alone, and they feel the growth of that too in our smaller rural communities. The committee is the forefront of our committees. We feel that we've been further ahead than some. As Anne had mentioned earlier, we've been working since April of this year and continuously are being involved with the community. Brian had stated that he feels that we really need to count human beings, not populations of different diverse groups, etc., and that we need to provide for them whether or not they're here legally or what have you, that it is our duty and obligation to adhere to providing for them as a community, and we need those resources. And the school credo is to educate all, and as his job is to make sure that his population is educated, and that he's not a cop or an immigration officer or something to that when it comes to the census. It is making sure that everybody is counted so he can do his job in education. I believe that's all he had.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Kiefer. Any questions from any of the members? Great. Thank you for stepping in for Mr. Boysen. And we'll now move to Zhang-Pao Li from the Minnesota Census Mobilization Partnership. Try to, again, 3 minutes.
Keep it short, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Zhang-Pao Li, a.k.a. XP, and I am the Program Manager for Policy and Special Projects with the Minnesota Council on Foundations. I'm helping to lead the coordination of the Minnesota Census Mobilization Partnership, which some of you have heard about today. This work actually started back in 2015 between conversations of Bob Tracy, the previous director of policy at MCF, and Susan Brower, and some of our national partners, specifically Joan Namark from MAX 2020, which is the Minnesotans for the ACE American Community Survey. And this is so, as Andrew alluded to before, this work started, you know, years ago. And we're literally working with everyone, from the Census Bureau to the state to our philanthropic membership, which includes over 150 different foundations from across the state, to local organizations, to national advocacy partners, to on-the-ground grassroots groups. We're trying to coordinate the engagement specifically towards the historically undercounted communities in Minnesota. So to that end, I just want to say here, I welcome any questions or any connections that I can help build to support that to that end. I wanted to just bring up a couple points, and I also wanted to say that as we talk about funding, as we talk about representation, I'm so glad that the lady that came before me brought it back to our humanity, because being counted in the census is a human right. You don't have to be a citizen to be counted. As long as you reside here in the state, it is your right to be counted in the census, so that all of the decisions that are being made by your elected officials, by businesses, by financial institutions, by your schools, everything that affects your quality of life, you are invisible in the data. You do not exist if you are not counted in the census. So let me put that forward to this committee, as well as to everyone, that there is another layer of how important the census is to being a part of the American tapestry and story. So with that, I just want to point out, we do have our work focused through five hubs, tribal, nonprofits, Greater and Rural Minnesota, CCCs, as well as a grassroots Our Minnesota Census relational organizing campaign. And then we have wraparound allies and partners that help to support that work. So we will have we already have our nonprofit grants out along with our CCC grants. So if anyone would like more information about that, feel free to contact me. But you can also go visit MinnesotaNonprofits.org. And, the Council on Nonprofits website will have information on that grant out as well. And those are for all nonprofits. You don't have to be a member of Minnesota Council on Nonprofits, and you don't have to be a CCC to apply for those grants. Otherwise, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Any questions or comments from committee members? Great. Thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you.
We'll now move to Tom Wiesen. And please state your name for the record, and just so you know, I'm going to start timing because we're getting close to the end.
Sure. My name is Tom Wiesen.
Folks will stay.
I've not been involved in politics for much of my adult life. As a resident of Minnesota, father of two school-age children, I started paying attention to the corruption in government. The more I learn about how government operates, the more frustrated I get. There are parallels between government and the corporate world. As companies grow, they often don't update their infrastructure at the same rate until systems become so ineffective that they start to choke the organization. Our government has become so riddled with corruption in the form of election financing, super PACs, political party-controlled primaries, a deaf ear to constituents, and gerrymandering that has become difficult performing basic functions such as passing a budget. I live in a gerrymandered district. Two of my representatives have been in office a combined 41 years. I voted for the incumbents in my district, but it's not like I had much of a choice. Because it is gerrymandered, there are no viable contenders in elections. Long shot opportunities do not draw quality people that will govern rationally. It also means that incumbents have no incentive to hold town halls or participate in debates. In Russia, people only get to vote for one party. In my district, only one party has a viable candidate. Voting when you don't have viable choices is not freedom. Fair definition of voting districts is a requirement to have freedom, choice, and competition in elections. As a manufacturing engineer, I know all too well that robust processes are required to accomplish repeatable positive outcomes in the long run. Robust processes, when followed, negate the accidental or intentional contrary actions of the people executing those processes. The greed for re-election, fundraising requirements, the need to feed the political party that got them in the office, the need to feed the 0.05% of wealthy donors and special interests that will need to pay for their re-election heavily influences elected officials' behavior. There are too many temptations to take shortcuts to stay in office. There needs to be objectivity and zero influence by elected officials and political parties when defining voting districts. Voting districts need to be selected by an independent, nonpartisan group of citizens using well-crafted, robust processes to create competitive, balanced voting districts. I urge you to work with Common Cause, Represent Us Minnesota, and the rest of the redistricting coalition to conduct an accurate and comprehensive census and to develop fair redistricting process that will end gerrymandering and ensure that competitive elections in Minnesota.
Great. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Wiesen. And any questions or comments from members? Again, thank you. Really appreciate you coming and testifying today. Next up, we have Nick Harper. Mr. Harper, please state your name and your affiliation for the record and proceed.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nick Harper. I'm the Civic Engagement Director for the League of Women Voters of Minnesota. Thank you for your time today. I will keep it short. Regarding the census and redistricting, there are two handouts in your members' packets that I would like to refer you to. I won't go over them, but there's good information on there for you. And if there are copies in the back available for the public as well. Touching on the census, I just want to point out we have heard a lot of great testimony about the amounts of money, but I wanted to touch on what specifically that money goes to help give some context to that. The two examples I use, one of them is census-based funding is used for school nutrition programs, so that includes free and reduced cost lunch and breakfast for our children. So when we're talking about census dollars, we're talking about children being able to eat and to go to school and not feel hungry. I also want to point out that some of the census-based funding is also set aside specifically through the Department of Agriculture for rural programs. So there are home loan programs, community loan programs, rental assistance programs that are specifically set aside for rural areas. And so that is also very important to many Minnesotans. Touching on redistricting very briefly, I could talk to all of you for hours about every aspect of redistricting, but I will give you one message today, and that is whatever you do during the next cycle for redistricting, whether or not you pass some kind of statutory or constitutional reform, your primary concern that you need to be considering is this process open? You need to be ensuring that the process is open so that members of the public can participate and also see for themselves that the process has been an honest one. They don't have to rely on hearsay from someone who is in the room. They can see it with their own eyes that the process was open. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Harper. And before you go, there might be some questions. Any questions or comments from members? No, you got to pass this at this one. Next up, we have Deborah Zavorsak.
Thank you so much. May I close this laptop? Is that going to mess anything up?
We won't mess anything up, so please state your name for the record and proceed.
Deborah Zavosek. I'm here as a volunteer speaking for myself and also as a member of a broad multi-partisan coalition. I submit this written testimony to share my own experience and that of my fellow volunteers. Sorry, I'm here to enjoy the fireworks. That was the curt response that I got from a gentleman on the Stone Arch Bridge on July 4th at the fireworks, whom I approached clipboard in hand for our redistricting reform bill. I was quickly filled with self-doubt at the wisdom of choosing the 4th of July fireworks venue for petitioning, but then I heard a woman next to him say, "Please hand me that clipboard. I'd like to sign it. This is a really important issue." So I pressed onward, and before the fireworks started, was able to get another 40 people signing the petition, and people were lining up behind me. I actually had a sign on my back and a sign on my bike saying, "Declare independence from partisan gerrymandering." So people were literally walking up to me to sign. Fast forward to August, when I was on my bike riding downtown in the bike lane, and I was passed by a guy on a road bike who had a sign on his back that said, "MAGA Trump 2020. So at the next stoplight, I pulled up and we were chatting as we rode along, and out of the blue, before we got to the next stoplight, he said, "I love your sign on your bike. Partisan gerrymandering drives me crazy." So of course, at the next stoplight, I had him sign my petition. So my point is that we in this room know that Minnesota has not been subject to the gerrymandering that other states has, but that's largely because we've had divided government and it's gone to the courts. And that's not to say that it couldn't happen in the future with one party controlling all the bodies of government. And everyday Minnesotans of all parties with whom I've spoken absolutely hate that idea. It's an issue of basic fairness. Another issue I was reminded of was at a Rotary Club, because we've been out petitioning and talking with various groups, and a Rotary Club member, we were discussing the situation of gerrymandering in Minnesota, and he said, "But what about incumbents? Isn't it true that districts can be drawn to include or exclude incumbents?" And I said, "Actually, that is true, and that's a big problem as well, and citizens hate that idea too." So I'm just one volunteer in a broad-based multi-partisan coalition that's been going around Minnesota. We have an online petition, and we've also made 2,500 person-to-person contacts petitioning and door-knocking around the state. I've personally door-knocked from North Branch down to Faribault yesterday. Other volunteers have talked with folks from as far north as Morrison County and down to Rochester. And I was actually at the Olmsted County Fair and talking with folks, too. We've got lots of questions and feedbacks. Everyone, as Mr. Harper said, everyone feels very strongly about the issue of transparency in an open public process. Everyone is signing the petition. We don't ask people their parties when we talk with them. We talk to people walking their dogs. We go up to any open door, and they almost inevitably want to sign the petition, grab a yard sign, and say, yes, we need this to be fixed this next session. So I would like to just urge you to proceed with what we would urge you to proceed with, the bill that we're working with Representative Jenny Cleavorn, who is the sponsor, which would be to establish an advisory commission of public members, citizens. People really like this idea as well. And they would do the redistricting in an open, fully transparent process guided by redistricting principles. Finally, I would just like to mention that we've had now over 5,000 signatures on the petition. We're going to be talking with, and we are talking with, people all around the state. So I just respectfully ask that you continue to talk with us and our coalition, because we've been really out getting ideas and suggestions from the community. And in response to the issue that was raised by Representative Freiberg and Representative Dean earlier about the timeline, we are very concerned that if the constitutional amendment is put on the 2020 ballot, there be a backup advisory commission, which could be enacted by the end of the 2020 session by legislative move, so that if the 2020 constitutional amendment doesn't pass, we have a backup and we still end up with an advisory commission. That's a model that you'll see on your handout in your packet from Common Cause Minnesota. Anastasia Belladonna Carrera, who's the executive director, talks about that option. And finally, your question, Representative Freiberg, about how many states have commissions. Apparently, my sources tell me that it's 21 states, and of those states, 13 use commissions exclusively to draw the maps. And there are commissions of various composition, but I can tell you that the commissions, fully independent commissions in California, Arizona, Washington, and Idaho, have passed maps. The Arizona maps were challenged. They've already been in cycle for a cycle already, and they went up to the Supreme Court, and the maps were upheld, drawn by an independent commission, and Common Cause was actually involved in that legal suit. So they're a great resource, and we hope that our coalition can be a great resource for all of you, and thanks so much for your time and your work.
Thank you for your testimony. Do members have any questions? We have a question here. Representative Turgeon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure I heard you correctly. Are you advocating that if we put this on the ballot for a constitutional amendment, we have a backup plan to circumvent the wishes of the voters if they vote no, so we still establish a commission anyway? Is that what you said?
No, it would be. It's actually the bill that is proposed, HF 1605, would create an advisory commission which works hand in hand with the legislature. So it's a difference there in that is what is constitutionally established. And the commission would be public members working in an open process with the legislature. That is already enabled by statute and by the Constitution. The alternative track is, should the voters decide that they want to have an independent commission, that would have to be established by the constitutional amendment.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you. Any other questions by members? No? Great.
Thank you
for your testimony. And I don't have anyone else on the list, and we've got like 3 minutes left. I'm not sure what happened today, but I will let one person, if they want to come forward and grab the microphone, you have 3 minutes. When you get up here, please state your name for the record and proceed. And again, we're trying to get out of here by noon, so appreciate it.
Sounds good. My name is Michael Stimple. I am also with Represent Us. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to take up all 3 minutes. The one thing that I wanted to say real quick is, well, first, to encourage everyone to read George Washington's farewell address. Most people have completely forgotten it, but you might need a dictionary for it, but it's well worth the read. And the reason why I want to come up here and sit and talk is because I feel it's important to mention that our Americans and liberties as freedoms are defended in part by our democracy, by we as citizens getting out and voting, and by making sure that our politicians are accountable to the people. This is one of the ways that we protect our liberties and freedoms that we as Americans hold dear. And in order to do that, we need to make sure that we have fair, non-gerrymandered districts. And that is why doing this fairly and openly is so important. Just want to say that. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, We're going to give 1 minute since there's another minute left. Please state your name and proceed.
Chairman and reps, my name is Luke Varian. I'm a citizen of Minneapolis, but I'm originally from Hastings. I believe that Governor Walz's message of One Minnesota would be strengthened by Jeanette Cleveland's bill for to establish a citizens redistricting commission. Pulling together citizens from rural Minnesota and urban Minnesota to draw maps is one of the greatest examples we can do right now when our house is split. I have knocked on doors in cities like Burnsville where things seem more purple than red or blue, and I have never been turned away by unpleasantness. I have stood with neighbors as they talk about these things that they hold dear. Strangers putting their names down on a petition to see how they can help defend democracy. For me, this is the evidence we need that the people are ready to hold at bay any threat that partisanship may give them. That's it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. And with that, I believe we're close enough to noon, unless members have any comments. Representative Bing.
I'll keep it quick. I just want to say thank you to all the testifiers who came here today to testify, and thank you in particular for our due diligence when it comes to making sure that every vote counts, that every individual counts. And in terms of this last item, at the risk of playing my hand, I want to say that I think this is an issue of basic fairness. It's about making sure that we have a fair fight, and I want to thank you all and commend you for your efforts to make sure that that happens. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Boehner. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just want to echo the thanks to everyone that testified, especially for our local community members that came up here today, too. As you can see, all of us members here are from the Seven County metro area, and so having the opportunity to hear from you about the grassroots works that you guys are doing here in Austin and in Monroe County, it's really empowering and really enlightening for myself, at least, and I just want to say thank you all again.
With that, before I adjourn, I just want to thank all the staff with the House of Representatives that helped to make this happen. Of course, thank you to the City of Austin. And before I forget, I also want to thank the GOP researcher, Brian Cook, who came down to be with us today. So appreciate your participation. And if anything, my hope is that in the census, we'll be able to beat Wisconsin. So with that, we're adjourned.